So, Ananda Prabhu, I thought how we go about this. I think since you were here, but the rest were not here, but also there's some audience out there.
Yep.
I thought I could maybe just spend 10 minutes on recapping what we had last night,
okay.
And then pick up from there. So we. Okay. Okay. So, yeah. So last night I gave this presentation, Life Comes from Life, which gave like an introduction to the whole discussion of Darwin and evolution. I had some quotes from Prabhupada where he actually establishes that we should be interested in convincing people that God does exist. And in order to do that, we have to address especially the theory of Darwin and evolution, because that is the main atheistic theory in the modern world that convinces people that you don't need God to explain the world. And therefore, Prabhupada was very intent on that we actually deal with this scientific issue of Darwin and evolution. I quoted this professor, Ernst Mayr, in order to show that actually Darwin was more than just as another big scientist. His ideas changed the world completely from actually theism to atheism. There was a time before Darwin, there was a time after Darwin. And I quoted another, you know, contemporary scientist who said that Darwin's real accomplishment was that he showed you can explain life and the complexity of living organisms without having to refer to a creator. That was before Darwin's time. That was actually the general idea among scientists. Scientists were not anti-religious, as many think, but they were actually theists for the most part, because they understood life is too complex to be explained simply by laws of physics and chemistry alone. And I gave a few quotes. One was a quote from Isaac Newton, who said that this most beautiful system of the sun, planets, and comets could only proceed from the counsel and dominion of an intelligent and powerful being. That's a quote from a very famous Principia, maybe the most important scientific book ever written. In the middle of that, you find quotes like this. Or I quoted Carolus Linnaeus, or Carl von Linné, the most important biologist of all time. He was Swedish. He's the one who introduced the classification of living organisms in like, for example, you know, we humans are known as Homo sapiens. We all know that. So this system of giving like two Latin names to each species goes back to him. He classified all living organisms. So he quotes also in a, you know, he lives in the middle of the 1700s. I saw the infinite, all-knowing and omnipotent God. I followed his footprints over the fields of nature and saw everywhere an eternal wisdom and power and inscrutable wisdom. Last quote was from a professor who was living at the same time as Charles Darwin, and who just before Darwin published his Origin of Species in 1859, this is from 1857, he basically said that science, biology, natural history must be really an analysis of the mind of God. This is what he's saying there. I'm not reading all the quotes here again. I hope you can follow what I say, and then also, of course, it's a little distracting, something else, something different on the slides. Then we got to the point of Darwin publishing his Origin of Species in 1859. And in that book, he makes several claims and argues for them. One was that he argued that species were not specially created. Actually, he also argues they're not created at all. But special created means that they are created separately. Like, for example, you know, special creation means that humans were created separately and monkeys were created separately and elephants were created separately and each tree was created separately. That's special creation. He argues that instead we have all descended from one original life forms or a few original life forms, primitive life forms, and then just by generation after generation, greater variety arises, and gradually you get, you know, species, and then you get, variety becomes greater. Then you have genera, then you have families, then you have classes, then you have orders, and you know, in this way it becomes, you know, the variety becomes greater and greater over time, just by natural evolution. He was very insisting, Charles Darwin, on it should be natural. You know, it could be, some could say this evolution is God who is behind unfolding, you know, a plan of life, a design of life. But Darwin is very insisting on this, it's completely natural. So we touch upon that. We had this, again, this quote here from this Professor Ayala, where he said that Darwin showed how you can get the complex order and function of living creatures as a result of a natural process. But then I continued and said, actually, this is wrong what he's saying here, because Darwin did not show it. Because Darwin's original theory that he proposed in The Origin of Species was shown to be false within 1 or 2 decades after he published his book. It was shown that it was false. And the theory of evolution that evolutionists nowadays are accepting is not Darwin's original theory, it's a later theory which they call Neo-Darwinism. So Darwin did not show it. He showed you can argue it, but he didn't show that you actually can, you know, that you can explain all living beings simply by a natural process. And then I discussed how Darwin's original theory was wrong. One was that species can just change unlimitedly simply by, for example, by breeding. You can breed, of course, you can breed dogs. I gave the example of dogs, and you can get many different kinds of dogs, small dogs, big dogs, you know, brown dogs, yellow dogs, black dogs, dogs that smells, dogs that don't smell so much, dogs that have a lot of hair everywhere, and so on. But they're still dogs. And they don't become another species. But Darwin claims that they can become another species if you breed enough over millions of years. And I gave a quote from a very famous plant breeder who stated that that's not possible. You can breed within limits, and it can be great variety, but it's still within limits. And then Darwin's second mistake was that he thought that acquired traits are inherited, which means that what the changes that we affect to this body will be passed on to the next generation. For example, if I exercise and I get very, you know, wonderful big muscles and like that, then I would get children with bigger muscles. So that does not happen. But Darwin thought that, and Darwin needed this for his theory for this to take place. So these were the two basic faults in Darwin's theory. And so then I start discussing on Neo-Darwinism, which is the idea that mutations are the cause of the new variety that can be naturally selected for evolution. Because the thing is, you need new variety to appear. It's not enough that you have natural selection. Because selection is a negative process that reduces variety. You know, it's only those who are fit to survive; the rest they die out. But how do you get new variety to begin with? That is the real question. So Neo-Darwinism is the idea that mutations in the genes they cause new variety. Mutation is not Darwin. Darwin does not use the word mutation. It's not a word that exists at his time. It's a later discovery. There is first a discovery that species are very, very stable. They don't change. Darwin thought they could change a lot, but actually they couldn't. They cannot change, and that was shown especially by Mendel. you know, everyone here knows Mendel because he's just from very close to here. Afterwards it was shown that, yes, Mendel is right, they are stable, but then rarely there is a change. And these were, these are mutations. And of course, at that time, when they discovered mutations, they didn't know what it was. That was discovered in the 1950s, that it has something to do with DNA. And when DNA is copied, there are copying mistakes on the DNA. These copying mistakes, they are mutations. So, but in any case, that became the idea that mutations, they give rise to new variety that then can ultimately give rise to new species. And then I looked at that idea. I gave some examples where that doesn't seem to be very likely also. First, I discussed there are examples of some positive mutations, but they are very rare. And I gave the example of sickle cell anemia, which is a disease where it's a very severe blood disease that is caused by mutation. And those who have that disease, 25% of them die from it. But the funny thing is that those who have this disease, they are immune to malaria. So in areas where they have malaria, they survive in greater numbers than those when there's an epidemic of malaria. So that was quoted as a favorable mutation, but you can see it's not completely favorable. It has its disadvantages, such as a 25% mortality rate, which is not very favorable. And I went on to discuss about the malaria parasites and why are they not? Didn't they develop tolerance to lower temperatures? Because it's a tropical parasite and they cannot exist outside the tropics. And why didn't they, by mutation, develop tolerance to lower temperatures? Because the example is that actually there have been so many parasites of these malaria, that there have been more malaria parasites than have been mammals for the last 100 million years. And they claim that all the great variety of mammals arose by just through mutations. But it turns out that even such a simple thing as to develop tolerance to lower temperatures cannot, in the case of malaria parasites, happen because they need many mutations to happen simultaneously, that is completely unlikely it will ever happen. So that's I gave some examples like that, and then I quoted this. There's a statement we are on the. You can find it on the net. It says we are skeptical of claims for the ability of random mutation and natural selection to account for the complexity of life. Careful examination of the evidence for Darwinian theory should be encouraged. This statement is signed by now 1,000. Natural scientists, PhDs in physics, chemistry, biology, biochemistry, geology, mathematics, who says, yes, the theory of Darwinism or neo-Darwinism is not really supported. We need to have more research, actually. So that theory is also, it doesn't seem to be the explanation for evolution. And I went on to show that by another example. This is, there was a scientific conference in Austria in 2008, where 16 of the world's leading biologists were invited to discuss, This was from the invitation that was sent out to the biologist, where it was stated, not only we have witnessed a molecular revolution from the discovery of the structure of DNA to the genomic era, we are also grappling with the increasing feeling that we just don't have the theoretical analytical tools necessary to make sense of the bewildering diversity and complexity of living organisms. And, in other words, this is the essence of that quote. We don't have the theoretical tools necessary to make sense of the complexity of living organisms. In other words, we don't have a theory that can make sense of the astounding complexity that have been discovered, especially on the molecular level. Of course, living beings are astounding, amazingly complex on all levels. But they had the idea, Darwin had the idea, that the complexity is only on the, you know, on the macroscopic level, on the level that we can perceive. Of course, there it's very complex with, you know, it's, you know, organs and blood streams and nerves and so on. But the idea was that behind that there's a simple foundation. Cells are very simple. But what scientists have discovered since the 1950s and onwards is actually, no, it's the opposite is true. Cells are even more complex than what we can observe on the macroscopic level. The cells are the most complex we've found anywhere. One cell, you know, tiny, tiny cell, is more complex than what goes on in the entire city of Ljubljana. You know, and you know how many crazy things goes on here probably. People are so busy and so many activities and, you know, factories and people running here and there and moving and cars and so on. But one cell is more complex than that. So, and I showed a film. Do you want to see this film again? Do we have time for that? Yeah, because you didn't see it. It's quite interesting. That gives you really idea what I mean goes on inside a cell. First, you have some scientists discussing the complexity of cells and what Darwin thought of cells and what we now know about cells. And then there's an animation that gives a little idea what goes on inside a cell, just to give us an idea what we are talking about. So let's see.
A Buick. What is the cell now in terms of its complexity by comparison?
A galaxy.
If Darwin thought a cell was, say, a mud hut, what do we now know that a cell is?
More complicated than a Saturn V.
So what is in a cell as far as we know now?
A world that Darwin never could have imagined.
I needed someone who could give me a glimpse into this world. So we went to molecular biologist Doug Axe.
Think of a cell as being a nano factory, a factory where, on a very small scale, digital instructions are being used to make the components of the factory. Here we have the famous DNA double helix. You can see the two helical strands that are intertwined and wind around each other on the outside of the molecule. This is the material that stores all of our genetic information. In higher life forms, this will be the equivalent of something like a gigabyte of information stored in the molecules that form the individual chromosomes, all packed within the nucleus, which is a tiny fraction of the entire cell size. So what does DNA do? Well, the information in DNA ends up providing the information for sequencing the amino acids to make proteins. We have information in a one-dimensional form that provides the information for a three-dimensional form.
And then It was just a last slides from yesterday. You know, I quoted Prabhupada. You know, scientists must admit that they still do not know the origin of life. They claim that they will soon prove a chemical origin of life is something like paying someone with a post-dated check. This is quote, famous quote from Prabhupada, and Prabhupada was correct back then, and he's still as correct today. I quoted some different scientists who were stating the same thing, concluded that there's really no theory of evolution in scientific terms. There's a story that has been told, but there's no scientific theory that can be tested. So that's actually where the theory of evolution is. And I ended up this was the last picture last night. This is actually Sataputta from a lecture in front of Prabhupada back in 1976, where he said, "We like to argue that the chance of molecular forces theory won't explain things like this, but to say that there is an intelligent designer would be a sensible explanation." So now that introduces the term intelligent design that also other scientists are using and saying that life and all the evidence in biology points to a form of intelligent design. So today I want to at least do that, discuss it, what is meant by that and how is intelligent design being inferred and what is evidence of intelligent design. And maybe if we have time, but I don't know if that's... What is our time limit, Prabhu? 9 o'clock?
9:15, we'll see. We will see how far it...
Okay. You're not stressed or... As always, we're always stressed.
Then we are controllers.
We control... So, let's see here. Is it... Yeah, so I'll continue here. Here is a quote from Prabhupada. You know, the intelligent man can see that neither the living entity nor the phenomenal world are creations of chance. The symmetry of creation and its regulative actions and reactions suggest the plan of an intelligent brain behind them. And by genuine inquiry, one may find out the ultimate cause. And Robert Moore, when we speak of law, we must understand that there must be a lawmaker. And science is discovering some subtle laws of nature. But who made that law? As soon as you say that here is a law which is being carried very nicely, there must be a lawmaker. So what Robert is arguing here is that you can look at certain symptoms in nature, for example, and you can conclude that this cannot be result of just some chance or some natural process, but it is a result of some intelligence behind this, intelligent creator behind. So, and that's basically what intelligent design means. Here is a definition. It means a feature that cannot be the result of any known physical process or of chance, and which is best explained as a result of an intelligent cause. Does that make sense, or do you understand what is meant by that? I'm going to give you some examples to illustrate. But like as I mentioned last night, we sit here in a room, and is it a naturally arisen room? Or like a mountain cave, for example, that's also a room. But nobody created a mountain cave. It arose by natural processes. So are we in a room that has arisen by a natural process, or is it a result of a creation process and a design process? I mean, we all know that it's obvious. This was not created by chance. Sometimes we... I guess, do you sometimes have school classes here? Yeah. So then you tell the Big Bang building theory. You do that when you have school classes. I mean, it's it's a little funny, and it makes everyone think that, you know, once here, at this plot here in Ljubljana, many years ago, there was just a big pile of bricks, big, big pile of bricks, and also other buildings materials and like that. And then one day some naughty boys, they took a lot of explosive dynamites and put under all the bricks and so on. And then they exploded the whole thing. And it was really a big explosion. It was like really a big bang of explosion. And all the bricks were thrown out into, you know, outer space and were circling around. And then finally it fell down and pff, same place again. And then the house was there, you know. So, I mean, it's everyone can say this is absurd. This is absurd. We can see this is not the building here was not created as a result of some. There was a desire to have a building. There was definitely some architects who were making drawings. There were engineers who were making calculations, and then there were the practical people going and, you know, putting all the elements, building elements together. So we finally have this beautiful building here. And we can, I mean, so it's obvious, this is, and we even do it unconsciously, we don't, but we can see, we can distinguish between things that are as a result of an intelligent creation process or things that are naturally, arise by natural processes. So intelligent design is a feature, a structure, or an event that doesn't seem to be a result of just a natural cause, but there is an intelligence activity involved. So you understand? Yeah. I'll give you some examples of intelligent design from, for example, archaeologists. That's what they are doing. Here is a big rock, an archaeological piece. Some parts of this rock can be explained naturally. It's a piece of granite. It's a volcanic stone. And some of this shape was formed by actually glacier processes. Where you find it, it's a famous Danish rock from the Viking Age. So why you find that in Denmark was actually because it was moved by glaciers from northern Scandinavia. So that's explained by natural processes. But then again, you have also these carvings, on the stone. That's not a result of any natural process. That's obviously a result of an intelligent activity. Or you find, you know, pieces of flint like that. And archaeologists, they will study flints or pieces of stone. And they'll ask, is everything on these stones the result of a natural process, or are there features such as edges that must be the result of some humans chipping on them or something like that? And, I mean, in this case, these are actual implements. These are some flints or some piece of stone from Indonesia, actually, from where archaeologists discovered these, which I might be touching on. I think I'm going to give the forbidden archaeology discussion tomorrow, so this is one example from there. But here, the archaeologists conclude this was not a result of any natural process, this is a result of intelligent activity, these stones here. Searching for extraterrestrial intelligence, SETI, you know, you're aware of the SETI program, it is scientists, astronomers who are scanning the night sky for radio signals to discover if some of these radio signals maybe could be contain messages from intelligent beings. I mean, there are lots of radio signals coming down from the space, stars and so, and other heavenly bodies. They emanate radio signals, but so far they haven't found any example of intelligent radio signals, but they are hoping they can find it. In a film, I mean, in real science, they haven't discovered it. But a film was made one point called Contact. Someone saw that film? Is that a famous film? So actually, there in the film, they actually got a radio signal, and they concluded this is not noise. This actually has form. This must be a result of intelligence. And what was it that they, why did they conclude that? Because the signals were, you got, they got beeps of all the prime numbers from 1 to 101. Now, prime numbers are, the prime number is a number that can only be divided by one and by itself. It's not a, it's not a, a product of a multiplication of other numbers. So you have, you know, prime numbers are like 1, 2, 3, 5, 7, 11, 13, 17, 19, and so on. So they got a signal that spelled out the prime numbers from 1 to 101. So they conclude this cannot be, you know, this cannot be chance. This must be intelligent. So that was intelligent design they discovered there. This is George Harrison. We all love George Harrison. But once, you know, there was a court case against George Harrison at one point, actually on My Sweet Lord, a fantastic song, but it was he was accused of having copied it or plagiarized it from a previous song, and actually I think he lost a court case. Isn't, I mean, do you know that? Or, but, yeah. My Sweet Lord. Which song you before? It was a song called "He's So Fine" that was someone wrote a few years before, and actually they concluded that it's it cannot just be chance that these two songs are so identical. He must have copied it. He said no, but maybe he did it unconsciously. Who knows? But that's actually also that's also discovering. You know, this cannot just be chance. Or an example here. This is a map. Of parts of Scandinavia. There's a question here, how do publishers of maps, or in the old days before you had electronic calculators, you had tables of, you know, you had tables of sinus and cosinus and logarithms and like that. You familiar with that? Mm-hmm. You know, it was before anyone knew. Yeah. Yeah, and you had just tables, you know. So someone has been, you know, calculating you know, the sinus of this angle, you know, and the sinus of this angle. And it was a big work to sit and make all these calculations and then publish them in a book, just as it is a big job to make an accurate map and then publish it. So the question is, how do these publishers, how do they protect their copyrights? Because, you know, you cannot copyright the right answer to a, you know, a logarithm. Anyone can calculate it. Or a map, you know, you cannot copyright, you know, because the land is already there. Do you know how they protect their copyrights? Huh? Of maps or these tables, they introduce mistakes in them. You know, on the map, there can be a small town that is not there. Or a feature, like a bay that's not there. Or in the tables, there will be on the, maybe on the sixth or eighth decimal, there will be a mistake, a few mistakes here and there. So if someone copies, you know, they cannot, you know, they will get the right answers, but they cannot have the wrong mistakes also. Then they get them. In this way, that's also inferring intelligent design. They cheated. It wasn't just chance. They cheated. Like that. So these are examples of, you know, this called inferring design is done in many fields. You know, also like in criminal investigators, they do that all the time. You know, was someone, did he just fell? Was it just chance? Did someone push him? Like that when, you know, that's the question is how to infer intelligent design, and there are different proposals, but the one that is the most precise that I've seen and is being most quoted is called conclude. You see some evidence and then you conclude from there. That's called infer, and you talk about an inference. It's a conclusion, more or less the same. So how to infer intelligent design? One mathematician, Bill Dembski, developed what he called his explanatory filter, where he introduced a concept that he calls specified complexity. And I'll go through, I'll show you what it means by this specified complexity, and how when you find specified complexity, you can conclude this is a result of, this is a design. Specified complexity cannot be the result of a natural process or of chance. So I hope you can understand what is meant by it. Here is the filter. So through this filter, because you start with start, and then you first ask, is this that we are discussing, is that contingent? And if you say yes, then you go on and ask, is it complex? And if you can answer yes, is it specified? Yes, then it's design. And I think you're lost right now. You didn't understand what I meant by that. So I'll give you an example.
What does it mean by contingent?
I'll get to that. I mean, so far I know you lost. But so imagine a monkey sitting on a keyboard at a computer, or so we want to know, is a monkey intelligent or not intelligent? So we just ask him to punch something on the keyboard. So this was the first. Is that an intelligent monkey? Well, the first thing we have to ask, contingent, means it wasn't that he had to punch AS, he could have punched anything. Contingent means it's the opposite of something that is a law. If, for example, I take this, I drop it. I do it again, I drop it. That always happens, that's a law. So that means it's not contingent. Contingent means it doesn't have to happen, but it can happen. That's the word. So that's the first thing. There was no natural law involved that forced a monkey to write AS. Okay. Because otherwise, if it were, then it would immediately go out. It's not contingent. Then it's a necessity. It's a law. And laws like that, that's, you know, that can explain without design. Then the next question is this a complex string of letters? The answer is no, it's not a complex string of letters. It's just two letters. It's very simple. Okay, that could be chance. We cannot write off chance. Then we have next time the monkey writes this. Again, this is not this is contingent. Yeah. Next question, is it complex? Yes, this is actually a very complex string of letters. Because I mean, it's long, you know, it's probably the first time in the history of the universe that anyone ever wrote this string of letters. It's actually complex. If something has a very low probability, that means it's very complex. That's one way of defining complexity. We can ask next, is it specified? Sorry if it gets technical. I hope afterwards you'll understand what I mean. And now it says, is this specified? And the answer is no. And you don't understand now what I mean by specified, but I'll next exam will show what is meant by specified. But here it says it's not specified, and therefore it can still be chance. There are many complex things that happen all the time by chance. Just something is complex is not enough to conclude that this was intelligently designed. You know, like for example, again, this falls, and you know, it's, you know, it's a law that must fall, but exactly it fell like this. You know, precisely here, in like this, on these molecules, touching molecules on this couch and like that, that only happens once, and that's very complex. But it was chance.
What is specified? I don't
understand. No. The next example I'm giving will explain what specified is.
Contingent, complex, and specified. What is it?
Yeah. Next example. Now you'll hopefully you'll understand now. Here is another string of letters, they are, you know, contingent. They're also very complex, but they're also specified. As a soul continuously passes from boyhood to youth to old age, the soul similarly passes into another body at death. Specified means an independent pattern exists that matches this string of letters. Did you get that completely? You know, the verse in the Bhagavad Gita already existed before the monkey was writing on the keyboard. So that's called the specification. Something that exists independently matches the event we're looking at.
From before that happened, not under
the engine. Yeah. It exists before or exists independently. Just like in Contact, the film Contact, the string of prime numbers exists independently of the radio signals that came down.
And it is produced by another intelligence,
maybe. You cannot say actually prime numbers are not created by intelligent beings. They are just mathematical property. Or recognized by intelligence.
We recognize it and others recognize it match.
Yeah, or it exists independently.
Yeah.
It's you might be the first time you even discovered prime numbers, but they're just mathematically significant. So it cannot be chance. So that's what a specification is. An independent pattern exists that matches this particular event. And so that's a definition, a complex feature that matches an independently existent pattern. When you find that, it must be a result of intelligent activity. Natural processes cannot make specified complexity like that. And that's Dembski, he says, specified complexity is a sure marker of intelligent design. Of course, I don't have that here. Okay. I'll give some examples where nowadays some scientists say we are finding examples of specified complexity in nature. It's called the anthropological principle, the fact that the universe appears to be fine-tuned for life or for human life. A number of physical constants have precise values that make life possible. If gravity, mass density, strong and weak forces inside the atom, etc., were only slightly greater or smaller, life wouldn't be possible. Of course, we're talking about Big Bang theory, and that everything happened in an instant of it, where the universe just came into being from some kind of explosive-like event. But things are... there's so many conditions that just happen to be just right to allow for elements to form, heavy elements to form that are necessary for life. And also many conditions on this Earth planet are so precise that if they were just slightly greater or smaller, life wouldn't be possible. So this fine-tuning is actually a specified complexity. I mean, life is complex, and I mean the constants in the universe, there are many of them. It's very complex, and then they have a precise value that allows for something as specific as living organisms. That's very specified. And so there are scientists who are saying that here is one British astronomer who actually originally was an atheist, but studying these precise values in the universe made him a theist. And he wrote, "I do not believe that any scientist who examines the evidence would fail to draw the inference that the laws of physics have been deliberately designed with regard to the consequences they produce inside the stars." And here is, I think, another physicist and cosmology, Paul Davies, he writes here, "Imagine playing God with the cosmos. Before you is a designer machine that lets you tinker with the basics of physics. Twiddle this knob and you make all electrons a bit lighter. Twiddle that one and you make gravity a bit stronger. You need to set 30 or something knobs to fully describe the world about us. The crucial point is that some of those metaphorical knobs must be tuned very precisely or the universe would be sterile. Yeah. So that's, you know, that's, you know, an example that, you know, actually many scientists are concluding that the universe must be designed. We think, and also often a basis on quotes and proverbs, Big Bang is a big problem for religion, and they have been, you know, they're able to explain the universe with the Big Bang idea. It's actually not correct. Big Bang is a big argument for theism. There were originally two competing theories. One was called the steady-state theory, and another was called the Big Bang theory. Steady-state was the theory that the universe is actually has always existed and is, has always been. And that would, you know, exclude the necessity of a creator. And most scientists, they like the steady-state theory because, you know, this of universe having beginning immediately. Of course, the answer is what was before. It looks like a creation event. But the evidence actually just seems to point to that the universe had a beginning, so they had to accept the idea of Big Bang. And many of physicists actually, they became theists because of that. This observation is one of the observations that supports Big Bang theory. Yeah, that the universe is expanding. That's a crucial observation. Yeah. Yeah, why they concluded and they accepted Big Bang theory was they discovered what is called the background noise. That's a kind of a signal that can only be explained as kind of the echo from the original Big Bang. It has no other source. That's.
Can I ask this? How this relates to your term specified
complexity?
No, these specific parameters of universe, like gravitational constant, because this matches our possibility of existence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The conditions for having life are very, very precise. And there's no reason why a universe arising by chance would have precisely these conditions. You know, the values of the many physical constants, they could have many different values. No, there's no reason why gravity should be exactly of this strength, or electric magnetism should be of that strength, or just that matter, you know, flying out from explosion, it should be distributed in a particular way. I mean, that's. So for all the properties to be exactly to allow for life is a very specific condition. So that's a specification. Even though you can say life did not exist. Is something that will happen later, according to this idea. Still, the conditions are a specification. It doesn't. Not that life has to exist before in order to fulfill the criterion of being a specification. You understand? So. Life as we know it, of course, here we're talking, you know, we're not talking about consciousness and all that. That, you know, we're just talking about the molecules and biology and like that. So, well, one thing is that life is dependent very much on carbon, you know, carbon molecules, you know, our bodies to a large degree are made from carbon. And carbon seems to be produced inside stars at the early stages of the universe. That's where the carbon is being produced. But if, and I mean, it's not exactly precise because I don't have the details right here, but something like, for example, if the attraction between, or the electric magnetic attraction inside atoms between electrons and protons had been slightly greater, then carbon would not be able to form. If neutrons were slightly heavier than protons, how is it now? Are they slightly lighter now than protons?
I think they're lighter.
Yeah. But if they were slightly heavier than protons, then these processes, they would not be able to happen. I mean, it is these, if there's many of these, if they just have been a little different, then many of the processes needed for allowing for life would not be possible. That's the argument.
Yeah, but with this specification, we would need another kind of life with another kind of conditions that would match. You know what I'm saying? If this what you meant by specified as
answer, yeah,
that this doesn't, these conditions match our life, but we would have to find a life based on another chemical elements and another.
Yeah, but you could maybe have. I'm sure you can. You know, it can be created with other elements also. Some bodies and like that. But still, everything has to be also, that has to be very specified. In the total number of possibilities, many will not allow any form of life to arise or life to exist.
Now they can say we adapted to these parameters. If parameters would
but
be different,
adaptation is an evolutionary term.
There's, I mean, adapted.
Yeah, that's okay. But there's no adaptation before life is there. You don't have, you know, if elements are not even formed, what will adapt? Adaptation is a term from evolution that something is making copies of itself with variation, and some of these copies are better suited to survive. But before you have something like cells copying themselves, there's nothing that can adapt.
But if something else, some other element would be formed, not carbon, then life could, they can speculate, could form out of those elements, which would match those parameters, which would
maybe
be different. You can speculate like this in eternity. That's what.
Yeah. But many things would. I mean, first of all, carbon is a very special molecule with really excellent properties. You can make, you know, is so flexible a molecule. You can have, you know, carbon which is very soft, but also diamonds. You know, it's the same molecules, but they're just, you know, structured differently. It's the hardest element, you know, not element, it's the hardest thing in existence, known existence. Carbon is extremely flexible, can be built in all kinds of shapes. So if you have another molecule that is just as ideal as carbon, maybe you could, but not any molecule could be used like that. Anyway, I mean, we can into little details, but I think you can. This is mainly just an example to illustrate what is specified complexity. You get that?
Yes.
Okay. Because I wanted to give another example here. This is when you get to biology, DNA, and in biology, everyone is familiar with the DNA molecule. It's kind of iconic. So what's interesting about DNA is that, of course, all the our genetic information is stored on the DNA. And here is a quote from Bill Gates, who wrote that the human DNA is like a computer program, but far, far more advanced than any software we've ever created. That is that's what is really the amazing thing about the discovery on DNA and how it works, that it's really digital technology inside our cells. DNA itself is a long chain where there is a sugar molecule and a phosphate molecule and a sugar, phosphate, just a long chain like that, millions of units long. That in itself is not, that is not what has, you know, is that's not the gene in itself. That's just, you know, might say, a memory where something is written on, if you compare it to a computer, memory. But what is the real genetic information is that on each sugar molecule is placed one of four possible nucleotides, they're called. They are some specific molecules. Four different molecules are placed there. And one molecule, and then a long string of these molecules creates a particular message. Just like on a computer, you have ones and zeros, long strings of ones and zeros. And with these ones and zeros, you can make messages. You can write letters. Like if you have eight ones and zeros, like this is in our computer. If you know that computer, you talk about bits and you talk about bytes. You know the difference. A byte is a letter, and a bit is a one and zero. So if you have eight ones and zeros in a specific combination, that codes, for example, for A. Another combination of eight ones and zero codes for B. And this way, you can create symbols for each eight, for each byte, you have a symbol. Does it make sense? Okay. So, and that's actually how computer code functions. These long strings of ones and zeros. On the DNA, you have four molecules where that are placed on the long DNA strand, and each three of these molecules forms a DNA letter. And then with these long strings of nucleotides organized in a particular sequence, that's actually what is coding in all the codes on the DNA. That's how it works. It's an absolute code that is there. And this is why Gates say this is like computer programs. It's digital technology, but it's just more advanced. It's much more advanced. And let's see, how was that? Yeah, we have the same phenomenon when we are dealing with language. It's also symbols. Symbols in sound carrying meaning. We know that is intelligently cost. We have software, intelligently cost, same phenomenon. We have a genetic code on the DNA. We don't know the cause of that. But, so what is the cause of that? You have the same feature, this kind of it's specified information. In all other causes, we know it's intelligently caused. So it goes, here is a quote from Newton, who said that the same natural effects we must Now, to the same natural effects, we must as far as possible ascribe the same causes. And Newton was arguing that if you, in Europe, you see a stone falling to the ground, and in America you see a stone falling to the ground, we can assume it's due to the same phenomenon, which he calls gravity. It's not that stones fall in America due to some different cause than they fall in Europe. It's the same law behind. So when you see the same natural effect, there must be the same cause behind. So here also, since we have known cases of information and we know the cause, here we have some information, we don't know the cause, but it must be an intelligent cause also. Was that the last? Yeah, on this one here. And really here also, it's an argument about specified complexity also. This information is obviously very complex, and we have specification in other cases where we know the cause. And so we can conclude also here, it must be an intelligent cause. So that was kind of that one. Any questions on that?
With this scientific research on human genome, they've discovered that that's only a small part of the whole DNA, and they're wondering if all the rest of the supposedly junk DNA is actually information about our spiritual world. What do you think about that? Are there information on scientists?
But actually, it has turned out that's been the research for the last, especially like 15 years, that there is no junk DNA. Only like 1 or 2% of the genetic code codes for genes, which is very specific. It is genes. The information is translated into proteins, and it turns out, and that was the first thing they discovered, that proteins are coded on the genes, and then they discovered that it was not only with the human genome, but also before that, they discovered that most of the DNA doesn't code apparently for anything, at least not for proteins. And then they said, they actually jumped to the conclusion it doesn't code for anything. So therefore, that must be the result of evolution, because a sensible creator would not waste so much, just have a lot of junk lying around. It's not, no sensible programmer would program like that. That was the argument. But actually, what has been discovered over the last 15 years now is that it does code for a lot of things but not for proteins, but there are many other things that is coding for. There's control regions that controls other parts of the genome. A big project came out called the ENCODE project, which was a mega study of all kinds of, many results from many, many laboratories. They simply collected all their results, and they discovered at least at that time something like 85% of the genome codes for something. It has an effect, and they probably conclude that actually there doesn't seem to be junk in the genome anymore. I mean that you could hear that 15, 20 years ago it was very widespread. They would use the argument for junk DNA as an argument for evolution. It's not been used anymore because it has been shown actually there is no junk. Ultimately, it's a nice proposal, an interesting proposal. Maybe there's some, spiritual program. Of course, ultimately, everything is, you know, is a spiritual program, has a spiritual cause. But they have mapped out, you know, at least they have come to show that actually most of the genome is actually coding for something. It has function.
Now there are some spiritual groups, shamanistic spiritual groups from Amazon that are researching this Axis Mundi, supposedly this axis where we're supposed to be aligned with God and Creator, some sort of a spiritual connection or energetic line or axis. And I'm wondering, some of the shamans from Amazon claim that this Axis Mundi is kind of reflection of our DNA spiral
okay.
code. So
never heard it.
No, okay.
I mean, I have no idea about what it is.
Hare Krishna. It's more like a comment, or maybe if you can share your opinion. All this discussion about this Big Bang and intelligent design, it seems like, because, I mean, there's a lot of argument, good argument, that there should be or there is intelligent design. But it seems that this all these arguments and proofs, facts, are it's like a my way or highway process. My perception in this regard, and also when we try, also we had similar here like 10 years ago in Slovenia, is one very prestigious institute. Joseph Stefan is called. many years ago was conferences organized on cognitive science.
Okay.
Yeah, where they with this they wanted to explain understand the artificial intelligence, how it works, and it was a question about consciousness and that. And the organizers from that institute invite also many disciplinary areas connected with this. There were philosophers, there were neurologists, and there were also theologists. So they invite a wide forum discussion, and also Matsavatar from Italy,
okay.
Assembly, we organized it. He also attend this conference, and discussion was heated up. You know, like one was like a orthodox, like traditional mathematical approach, and one was like, you know, experiential approach from those who are into spirituality, and it seems that the one of the key questions also is what defines the science. No one speaks about philosophy of science, a special area of epistemology, because this is the area where because everyone claims according to his view, and this is a question, what is my proof or my explanation, it's all about epistemology, right? What we accept as a fact or knowledge
and a proof.
And personally I have a perception that devotees should put more energy into presenting Vedic epistemology.
Mm.
Because we have in the class, this is modern science works on logical positivism.
Mm.
Is the present definition of the science, right? Everything should, there should be some theory, some mathematical model, and there is experiment which wants to prove the theory or hypothesis. This is anumana and pratyaksha, right?
Yeah.
And but the devotees with Vedic epistemology could really introduce very powerful model of definition of the science. And because if you have anumana and pratyaksha and try to, with this anumana and pratyaksha, which is a lot of evidences and experiment is there. With this experiment, they can actually, and this is actually how it's in Vedic epistemology, you can prove Vedic statements, right? As the Prabhupada gives this simple example of cow dung, right?
Mm-hmm.
It does make sense, but even with experiment, they prove that cow dung has a antiseptic and whatever.
Sure.
So similar. There is not so much discussion, maybe from the other side, who can more introduce Vedic epistemology. because this is like a bottom line where discussion starts. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about what we accept as a knowledge. And actually, philosophy defines that science, right? Ultimately. It's not the science defines itself.
Yeah. It's
philosophers or the philosophy of science defines the science as the present is defined 200 years ago, right? By Voltaire.
Science?
Yeah, logical positivism, which is now valid as a science, is 200 years old.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like...
I mean, actually, the word science was constructed around 1830.
Yeah.
Before that, they didn't use the word science, they used the word philosophy. If you take Newton, he wrote his Principia, which is the most important scientific book written, but he doesn't use the word science anywhere. He talks about philosophy, or natural philosophy, or experimental philosophy. That's his terms. So science is it is philosophy, and it's a part of philosophy, and it's springing out of philosophy.
And what is interesting, that majority of scientists, they don't know about this.
No, they're not philosophers.
Yeah, they don't know that the philosophy of science is science of all scientists, is philosophy, which defines the science. A majority of scientists doesn't know. They doesn't know about epistemology.
Yeah.
I was in the research institute. No one knows about epistemology, and they're scientists.
Yeah.
This is where I think the system could be shaken up. Okay, let's speak about science of the science, philosophy of science, no?
Yeah.
Especially epistemology, which is really you have to deal with the fundamentals. Okay.
Mm.
Okay, this is how the system works now. But is there some, you know, alternative approach of defining science? And this is what is Vedic all about.
Mm-hmm.
We cannot argue only with the arguments which they are valid for the present so-called science. That was our experience in that conference, because I was just fighting here and there, because there was no discussion about epistemology.
Oh.
And this is one of.
And that's actually they're using epistemology to actually exclude discussions of intelligent design by trying to define science in a way in advance that you cannot discuss non-material causes. They want to. That's one trick, you might say.
Yeah, because it's established science has specific epistemology.
Yeah.
Protection and anumana. With that, you cannot. You cannot prove you cannot prove the metaphysics.
No.
You cannot. Metaphysics doesn't have place in a physical experiment, right? That's why it's metaphysics.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on what questions you're asking. But I mean, just back to this, I think the one who of devotees making the best attempts introducing Vedic epistemology was probably Suhota Swami.
Yes, yes. I'm just referring to that.
His, you know,
shadow and substance.
Yeah.
This, yeah, and yeah. Of course, Bhaktivedanta Academy in
Mayapur.
In Mayapur.
Yeah. So. And of course, ultimately, that's our, you know, this is our authority. Shabda is our authority. All this, you know, maybe it's important to emphasize. You know, I'm not trying to prove Krishna consciousness with all this, or you know, reads or you know, conclusions or uncover conclusions that. Have not been revealed through Shabda. I think this approach is, as Sariputta explained it, that Shabda is obviously our authority, and in a real philosophical discussion, we refer to Shastra, and then we say, you know, but Shastra says like, and then it's concluded. But what to do when we're dealing with people who do not accept Shastra?
Yes.
Well, then we have to, in one sense, meet them on their terms, which is pratyaksha anuman, which is, you know, positivism, science, you know, what they call science. So we have to, you know, meet them on their terms and then bring them just to the point of being open-minded. Actually, we don't know everything. And it actually makes sense to accept Shastra. Maybe you should. There seems to be an intelligence behind nature. So maybe that intelligence has also given us some information. Shastra could be that information. It's just to bring them to that point.
Yeah, right. To accept the Vedic epistemology.
Yeah, yeah.
Carl Sagan, famous cosmologist, he also hinted that he was studied, right?
Mm.
Vedic cosmology. Yeah. He was super impressed, right?
Because they had the same, number of years that you know the cosmologists had. I mean, not exactly, but same.
Yeah, it's not that pratyaksha anumana is like dismissed. No, no, use it. As Prabhupada said, with the cow dung, you know.
Yeah.
They prove it with anumana or pratyaksha. They prove that is held. I mean,
confirmed.
Yeah, they confirmed. Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it is used. It's not that we reject but we prove the shabdic statements.
Yeah, yeah.
This is the advantage of the world, the scientists, because they know the truth. So just as you're doing, you just pick. Okay, this is, they are doing experiments and theories. Just pick. Okay, and put it in the Vedic model. Yeah, you see, this scientists prove like that, and they prove that like that.
Yeah.
Because they have bought it.
Yeah.
But they don't have ultimate conclusion as a Vedic epistemology has, right?
No.
So this is the advantage of the world. So you know, okay, we should find the existed proofs for the Vedic darshan.
Because I mean, the Vedic is the kind of the complete picture.
Yeah, exactly.
The scientists, they are, you know, it's like they have a jigsaw puzzle.
Yeah.
And they, you know, with thousands of pieces.
Yeah.
So they find a piece here and they find a piece there and they have no idea how to fit them together. But, Shastra is the complete picture. Then you say, oh, here and here, this should be there.
Right.
Anyway, I mean, I don't have so much comment.
If devotees would just, or any academics is just study a little bit with substance and shadow, they would be really, they have a powerful tool not to be embarrassed in the academic world,
mm-hmm.
but they have really, really strong position in discussion about the Vedic, Vedic view. It's not like, you know, we are ashamed about, you know, Vedic statements and metaphysics. No, this is valid philosophical scientific approach. I mean, which usually we have Vedas, you know, they're not accepted as a reference. Usually they call it a reference, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think those should be more trained in the philosophy of science or Vedic epistemology.
Yeah.
Which is our foundation. Without that, I mean, what the hell?
No,
we are just in the pool. Modern science is.
Temples should be universities.
Sorry.
Temples should probably want temple to be universities, Vedic universities.
Yeah, but that's why Bhaktivedanta Institute was idea of that independent institute which would promote.
Yeah.
Promote the Vedic view.
Yeah.
Or more specific, Vaishnava. Gaudiya Vaishnava Vedic view, right?
Yeah.
Hare Krishna.
Thank you. I guess we should stop here.
I think yes.
We went over time already. Sorry for that. And we didn't cover. I had one more presentation I wanted to give, but anyway.
Tomorrow's another day.
Yeah. So maybe I don't know if you have that. I was planning to give Forbidden Archaeology tomorrow, but I can also give this one instead.
Tomorrow we hear usually Nam Yagya. Let's see. Yeah. Tomorrow is we have morning class and then we have Harinam if you want to join us.
Sure.
It's like 10:30 till lunchtime.
Mm-hmm.
In afternoon, 5:00 we have Nam Yagya, 3 hours of chanting. But let's see, maybe we can adjust because you are here. We can take an opportunity to hear more about.
Up to you. We don't
have much opportunity to discuss this topic because it's really specific and everyone is like aligned with that.
Yeah.
It's complex and needs a little taste for that.
Or we can maybe do it in another room. And those who are interested, they could maybe.
That's also a good option. Yeah. Okay, we'll find out till tomorrow.
Yeah, okay.
Upstairs,
huh? Yeah,
also.
Okay. Srila Prabhupada ki.
Jai. His Grace Lalitanath Prabhu ki.
Oh, Premanande. Jai.